Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks. This is Rachel Morrissey. I'm the executive producer. I wanted to let you know this week we are bringing you a special treat from the Next Money Conference in Chicago. The entire Breaking Banks family was at this conference. We're going to share with you Brett's keynote during the very first segment. And then in the second segment, we're going to share with you a panel that Ron Shevlin conducted with Duana Blomstrom, Derek Corcoran, and Chris Kovacs. We hope that you enjoy it. And we were going to come back to you next week with a regularly programmed show. So please enjoy and please let us know what you think. We love to have audience feedback. We hope you all have a great week.
Okay, so I wanted to start with the basic premise. If you hook into what JP's saying, the basic premise many banks have put forward is that there's a human differentiation to financial services advice. And advice is what differentiates, you know, the branch and the human advisor and so forth from purely digital. But this trend that we see in terms of technology that's disrupting financial services is attacking the way we think of advice. Think about how you get advice from a bank today. If you walk into an average bank anywhere in the world and you go in to get advice. Let's say you want to get advice on buying a home. You know, you walk into a branch and they say, great, you want to buy a home. Well, you need mortgage A or mortgage B. That's the advice you'd get. Or if you get a windfall, maybe your uncle leaves you some cash in his will, and so you go down to one of the banks and you say, listen, I just got some cash, I need to invest it. What advice do you get? Well, you don't get advice on your retirement and so forth necessarily. You pretty much probably get, well, you need asset class A or asset class B. And this is the sort of product-led advice that we tend to get from the banking system today. But technology-led advice is going to be different. It's going to be about placing financial services contextually and experientially in your life. That's the difference. The sort of advice that we're going to get from the technology layer is going to be acutely personal. It's going to be based on your behavior. But sort of there's this yin and yang with all of this. As technology has impact on our lives, and we all love these technologies, technology changes the way we interact in society. It's changed our behavior. Now, there's a long history, 200 years of history, around how technology has impacted us. For example, the first transcontinental telegraph line. It's from the east coast to the west coast of the United States. You know, you've probably heard of the Pony Express. Well, the Pony Express was how they used to get mail from the east coast to the west coast. 6 days after the first transcontinental telegraph line was completed, the Pony Express went out of business. I mean, that's disruption. No industry has ever survived technology disruption unscathed. So why is it we think the banking industry is going to be any different? Well, we're getting to that point now where banking is recognizing that this change is pretty inevitable. But the four major technology disruptions we're going to deal with that change our life, that change the way we work, will obviously be underpinned or started by artificial intelligence. So, you know, when we typically classify AI, we talk about three stages of development of artificial intelligence. We talk about simple AI right now, which is machine learning capability. The next stage we're aiming for, of course, is artificial general intelligence, where an AI can mimic a human, and then we get to strong AI. But AI is going to be more disruptive than the steam engine, than the telegraph, than all of these other technologies we've had in place. But embedded technology experiences is where banking is going to live. So whether this is smart glasses, embedded screens in your home, embedded intelligence in the world around you, as this technology gets cheaper, we become immersed in technology. And it just becomes usual for us. Data is really going to kill the way we think about onboarding and acquiring customers in the financial services layer particularly. anyone that still has a wet signature in 2025 probably won't be around. A requirement for a wet signature to open an account. Because competing in real time means you have to be able to do it off a databases. Now, we know Facebook, Apple, all of these companies right now are spending billions of dollars to lead this next charge in terms of computing platforms. Of course, AI is really still going to be key to this. Robotics is obviously part of this. But the reality is that robots do have are going to have a pretty significant role to play in value chain economics. Smart economies, again, will be underpinned by robotic delivery systems and autonomous delivery systems. So what that means is that by 2035, it's highly likely when you add up industrial robots, self-driving cars, robot vacuum cleaners, and drones and robots that are involved in value chain delivery, we're going to have more robots on the planet than humans. But when it comes to banking and financial services, I was looking for a way to describe the type of innovation we're seeing and whether that was disruptive and whether it was going to be disruptive to financial services. So when you look historically at major leaps in technology, the most disruptive technologies, there's actually a pattern. And that pattern is that those major disruptions that occurred with technologies occurred through first principles thinking. So first principles thinking produces step changes that we can't get with just iterating on banking the way we have typically. Now, when you think about that, how do banks respond to technology innovations? Well, let's think about the internet. When the internet came along, what did banks do? We looked at it and we said, this is great. Well, we don't want to sell anything on the internet because that would ruin the branch model. So what can we put on internet? Well, let's put statements on the internet, right? And that's internet banking version 1.0, right? And then mobile came along and we said, great, well, how do we get what we put on the internet on a smaller screen? This is iterative design, design by analogy. But if you think about other products that have had first principles design put to them, like the iPhone, these create massive disruptive forces because they change the way we approach the problem. Steve Jobs didn't take the Nokia banana phone, or the Motorola flip phone, or the StarTech, or the BlackBerry that we would have had probably back in, say, 2005. He didn't iterate on that to get the iPhone. He said, if we're going to take a browser, an MP3 player, and a phone, and put them together in a touchscreen device, what would that look like? And the story goes that he and Johnny Ive used to carry around a block of wood and sketch up on post-it notes how the device would work. This is first principles thinking. So when you apply this to banking, and we get the iPhone, instead of first principles thinking in terms of payments, we just tried to stick a plastic card inside the phone. Again, evidence of iterative thinking. So when you look at disruptive innovation, the most disruptive innovations are first principles, not iterative. So then the question is there evidence of first principles thinking in financial services today that could create this type of massive disruptive innovation? Well, I'll let this guy answer it, Jack Ma. I'll start this in a moment. So Jack Ma, if you guys don't know, he's the founder of Alibaba, also the founder of Alipay, and he's the second richest man in China today. But he started as a school teacher, and Alibaba is obviously a massive ongoing concern now, but this is how he thinks about competing with the likes of Walmart. Right, so this is him discussing a meeting he had with the CEO of Walmart and how Alibaba might be bigger than Walmart one day and why he said that would be possible. So let's hear what he had to say.
You know, you did a great job and blah, blah, blah. So I said, maybe in 10 years we'll be bigger than Walmart. He said, young man, you have a good hope. So we said, I'm going to make a bet. I think in 10 years we'll be bigger than Walmart on the sales, because if you want have 10,000 new customers, you have to build a new warehouse and this, that. For me, two servers.
I told this story in Thailand, And I realized that, you know, it's one of these English language things, because they said later, so what were the two services that he did? And I said, no, it's two computers, two servers, right? But here's the point, is that when you start thinking about this level of disruptive innovation and you start thinking like Jack Ma, he's saying, how do I acquire customers? Now, a bank's, you know, they're, you know, when you tackle digital with a bank, the compliance guys are saying, but we can't do away with the paper. We need the physical face-to-face. We need the signature. And this is the biggest hurdle to digital innovation in most banks today, getting away from this process we've had. Jack Ma, two servers. How do I acquire customers digitally in this world? And this is the first principles thinking to just this element. And it's been effective for Alipay. This is Yuei Bao. This is the single most successful deposit product in the history of mankind, right? Unless you take Solomon's Temple, maybe. But this example, $185 billion in assets under management in China, all based around mobile. Now, Jack Ma, when he built Yuei Bao, it was to leverage off people's deposits, companies' deposits that they had sitting in their Alibaba wallet from their trading on the platform. And he said, why don't you guys put that away in a savings account? And they were pretty competitive on the savings rate, but it wasn't the savings rate that got them $185 billion in deposits. It was that seamless ability to leverage off that behavior that already existed on Alibaba's platform. That's first principles thinking around savings. A behavioral approach to capturing deposits, not a real estate approach to capturing deposits. Now, before Yuei Bao came along, many bankers would have argued you need branches for deposits. But this is the most successful savings product that we have on the planet today. And it's all mobile. So when you think about this shift, what's actually happening is we're moving away from channels and products. We're moving to technology-embedded experiences for financial services. So this is sort of key to understand this shift that's happening with First Principles redesign of financial services. We're surfacing experiences. We're not pushing products across a new channel. This is the design shift. Uber's a great example of this. When Uber was trying to recruit drivers here in Chicago and in New York and in San Francisco, they ran into a hurdle where they couldn't recruit drivers fast enough. And they were watching the application process on the driver onboarding app, and they would find that people would stop at the debit card field because about 30% of drivers in these cities, they'd never had a bank account. So Uber went to the traditional banks and said, how do we solve this? They said, sure, send them down to the branch. They can sign a piece of paper or give them a piece of plastic if they're not too risky. Right? Uber said, that's not going to work for us. So they did a partnership with a fintech, Green Dot, and embedded in the driver onboarding app the process of getting an Uber driver debit card. That Uber driver debit card today allows them to pay you instantly as a driver. You can go out and drive for 4 hours and get paid within half an hour after you've driven. But the key thing was they got rid of the friction in creating a bank account so drivers could start driving straight away. And overnight, they became the third largest acquirer of small business bank accounts in the United States. But Uber doesn't want to be a bank. All they did was embed banking in the Uber driver onboarding process so they could grow their business. There's a truth to all of this. The fastest scaling, the fastest growing financial services businesses in the world today are not incumbent-led, they're technology-led. Because of what Jack Ma said, two servers, acquiring customers. So when you start thinking about AI and advice in this technology layer, the key challenge we'll have is, as humans, with this process-driven infrastructure we have in financial services right now, we won't be able to compete because data is going to be the differentiator. Just like a self-driving car that can capture 1,000 times more information than your human eye can see, we have an information asymmetry problem with technology. Technology enables us to better understand the needs of our customers and serve those needs contextually than traditional financial service products do. So if you were going to start from scratch with a first principles design to financial services, would we start with these buildings that require a signature on a piece of paper? Very unlikely. Instead, The core skills we need for smart banking today are completely different from what made banking viable in the past. Artificial intelligence, machine learning experience, contextual experience design, storytelling, identity management, behavioral psychology, digital community enablement, voice and personalization of advice, blockchain integration, these are all the skills of what makes a bank viable in the future. No banking skills are really required in this future, but technology skills are. And that's why TechFin and FinTech will be the largest financial services organizations in the future. And that's what I like to call Bank 4.0. Thanks very much, guys.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
What do financial services of the future look like? Invisible yet ubiquitous, blended into our lives like air, gravity, this podcast. Temenos has specialized for 20 years in creating the best financial technology for thousands of financial institutions worldwide. Our open fintech marketplace allows millions of people to experience money in exciting new ways. Join the most vibrant financial services ecosystem in the world. Temenos, we make the money go round.
Now, before we get back to talking about fintech, I want to take a quick moment to tell you about eFinancialCareers.com, one of the supporters of the show. They're the world's leading career site for financial service professionals for over 15 years. eFinancialCareers.com partners with leading financial and fintech firms, so your resume is seen by all the top companies and recruiters in the US and abroad. Now, as we all know, financial services is a very dynamic, ever-changing industry, and eFinancial Careers provides valuable resources from helpful career coaching to interview strategies and tools that keep you up to speed and well-informed with what's happening now in the industry and what it means for your career. Registration's free for financial professionals. Make sure you take advantage of all the resources they have to offer. So check them out, eFinancialCareers.com.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
I wanted to start off by letting you know a statistic that you probably have never heard before. Did you know that once in every 7 minutes, an article about bank and fintech partnerships is being published somewhere around the globe? It's true, one in every 7 minutes an article is being published. But I've got to tell you that every time I hear about bank and fintech partnerships, I'm reminded of the movie with Jack Nicholson called A Few Good Men. But what I hear Jack saying is, you want partnerships, you can't handle partnerships. Because think about it. Most financial institutions with less than $50 billion in assets does not have the skills and resources to partner with any meaningful number of fintech startups. If you're a mega bank, you probably can pull together the resources and skills to do it, but probably can't find enough fintech firms to partner with. And what makes anybody think that fintech startups have any skills in partnering? Problem is, I don't think partnership can really scale here to really cause any meaningful change in a lot of financial institutions. So what's needed and what is emerging is a new model, a new business model called platforms, a plug-and-play business model that enables both buyers and sellers to connect, interact, create, and exchange value. Now, to be a platform means that you have three capabilities. The first is you're a magnet. You attract both buyers and sellers to your business model. Second is you're a matchmaker. You help to match the right buyers to the right sellers and match help sellers to the buyers. And third, and very importantly, is you have a toolkit to enable the integration of the buyers and sellers on your platform. So we're privileged today to have representatives from three of these new platform services vendors today. Duane Blomstrom, the Chief Growth Officer of the Temenos Marketplace. Derek Corcoran, Chief Experience Officer at Avoca. And Chris Kovacs, CEO of Constellation Digital Partners. Guys, thanks a lot for joining us today. So I'm going to start with you, Derek, on Avoca. I want you to talk a little bit, give us the elevator pitch of what Avoca Exchange is, and who are the firms that are working you're working with to plug in capabilities into your platform and how that came about.
So let me just level set quickly. So we're a software company, and banks are using us for things like account opening, loan origination, applications for credit cards. And in order to do that, you need to do things like fraud prevention, KYC, AML, risk assessments, funding of a deposit account. And what we found was that our clients, the banks, wanted choice. They didn't want us to dictate to them who they were going to use for certain services, for things like fraud. And with all the investment that's going into fintech, they want to take advantage of that. But bringing, hands up here, who is from a bank? So would you describe it as easy to bring a new vendor into your organization? Yeah, the laughter tells me. So they were struggling with bringing these innovations. So all this investment's going into fintech, but you're like a kid in a candy store. You're kind of looking at it going, I'd love to have some of that, but I can't bring it in. So hence we built the Avoca Exchange as like a hub where we're kind of sitting there delivering the customer experience, but we wanted to create these connectors, pre-built connectors to fraud, KYC, AML, payments, e-signatures, and give our clients the ability to choose who they wanted to connect to.
So how many vendors are plugged in right now to the Avoca Exchange?
We have connectors built to about 50.
50?
Yeah.
Now, from a financial institution perspective, are they contracting with you for those services, or is it simple, or do they still have to contract directly with the provider?
Both. So in some situations, so take
fraud. That's not a great answer, both, because now you just added a level of complexity to the already high level of complexity.
Yeah, no, I absolutely understand mm-hmm. where you're coming from, and that's the reason we're supporting both models, is in some cases the bank wants to access that service provider through Avoca, but there are places where they want to access that service provider where they're not using us. So for example, if you want to use ThreatMetrix or iovation for device-based fraud prevention, you want to use that in your mobile banking app, and you want to use that every time somebody logs on to online banking through a browser. That's got nothing to do with Avoca. So they don't want to access that service provider and then be limited to only using that service in origination of new accounts. But there are certain integrations like for KYC, identity verification, that only apply in the context of onboarding a new customer. And so in those contexts, they actually do want to use Avoca. So, you know, services like MyTech, Yodlee, they can get them through us if they want to, if they're not going to use it elsewhere.
Now, a lot of the firms that you're working with on the exchange are fairly well-established companies. Have you been integrating and looking at the more emerging fintech startups, and what's your process for doing that?
Yeah, absolutely. The easiest way to talk about this is to give examples. So, you know, we may have a bank that's been working with one of the traditional bureaus for identity verification for, you know, a decade, but they see someone like Socure or Danal as an opportunity to introduce mobile, as in mobile carrier data, as a mechanism for verifying the identity of a customer. So it's not a replacement, but they're waterfalling. So they'll check with an Experian or a Lexus or an Equifax first, and then they'll waterfall into a Socure or a Danal to say, hey, so yeah, we're supporting the traditional players, but we're also supporting the fintechs because they're doing some really innovative stuff that the banks want to take advantage of.
Yeah. Chris, let me ask you to talk a little bit about what you're doing at Constellation. I got a whole bunch of things to delve into, but I think probably a lot of folks here are not familiar with Constellation.
Sure.
So it'd be helpful to give everybody the elevator pitch.
Yeah, most people probably haven't heard of us because we're a credit union service organization, so we're from the other side. We actually are an open online and mobile banking development platform for credit unions. And what that means is, and for fintech service providers. So we have a group of large credit unions who are very progressive in the use of technology and the advancement of technology. And we came together and developed a new model for integrating services in a way that allows any fintech provider to be able to create a service, deploy it into our platform, into our marketplace, and then credit unions can actually choose to buy that service add it to their existing mobile and online banking platform, and then it's pre-integrated to their core banking system. See, one of the challenges for credit unions, of course, is that as a community-based institutions, they simply don't have the same depth of resources that the very largest banks do. So, institution by institution basis, may be using different financial cores. So what we do is we actually provide that platform in between that gives a consistent means of creating and integrating services to credit union cores, and then we actually do the translation behind the scene. But what that means for credit unions is that now they can access the best and brightest thinking that's happening out there, and it is our hope to preserve community banking and be able to give community banks access to the same level of tools, the same kind of, you know, fintech startup opportunities that the very largest banks have today.
But the cores are going out to the mid-sized financial institutions,
yep,
and promising all of that themselves. And they also believe that they do have the brightest and best. And if you're from FIS or Fiserv, if you really do, so you're great. I don't want to piss anybody off at the break. So how does the mid-sized financial institution,
right,
work with you versus the cores who they're, you know, beholden to at this point?
Well, the difference is, and financial service providers come to us for a variety of reasons, and it is often based on their size. Very small startups come to us because we have access to 8 very large progressive credit unions, right? 8 credit unions that represent more than a million potential end users for their service. So for them, it's an opportunity to play up in the marketplace. I'm going to start, instead of having to start small and eke it out with one, I can actually go to the platform and play to a larger audience. The large guys, and I've had conversations with the Fiservs and the FIS and everybody else, they realize that the world is changing, right? Brett's message is getting out there to everybody, and they're looking at it and saying, how can I be more nimble? The fact is, our current providers aren't very nimble because they don't actually, in many cases, invent new technology, right? They buy it, they absorb it, then they have to integrate it into their business model and everything else, and eventually it ekes its way out through the sales process with that large provider. So they look at it as an opportunity, as for us in particular, is let's take a chance and work on what a new business model might look like. I had to provide one of the C-levels for Fiserv say to me, Chris, you're telling us to walk away from $400 million a year in integration revenue. And I said, no, I'm telling you to stop protecting film, right, in the way Kodak did, right? Integrating massive professional services engagements to integrate services together anymore are going away. So why not work with us in a way that allows you to start dabbling in this environment? And actually, they are receptive. Because part of it, too, is we're also consumers, right? Credit unions are the consumers of their products. So for them, they look at it as a part of this is offensive because, hey, there's an opportunity to sell into these organizations I haven't already sold to, and defensive. I have to protect what I've already sold. So the other unique thing that we do that's a little bit different is we actually don't call them partners. They are our customers. See, we're a true multi-sided platform. So my team has to add value not only for the credit unions, but also for the fintechs. They are our customers. In the same way that Xbox has to be a customer or has to be a provider for both hardcore gamers and the game companies, and they have to build a platform that creates value for both, that's our goal, is to create value for both of them.
That's why I'm looking forward to the session this afternoon that Lisa Goldshire will be leading on fintech partnerships. Because right, to some extent, my ranting and raving about partnerships is really about the label as much as it is anything else. I got some questions for you guys about the economics, but I want to bring Duane in and have her talk a little bit about what Temenos is doing with its marketplace, because you come from a different perspective here. You know, Temenos is a core provider, much bigger in Europe than over here in the U.S. But what led to the development of the marketplace, and what's your strategy for bringing a wider set of products and services to the Temenos customer base?
Thank you for setting it up, because what both these gentlemen said is essentially our model plus more. We are in a very fortunate position because we are both in the situation of a core vendor and are doing exactly the model you're talking about. So, but stepping back, couple of years ago, Temenos had a moment of aha where they decided they're not going to be doing their core product only. On the contrary, they're going to open up and at the same time stop developing things that they're not necessarily best at. So that was kind of a very clear self-realization moment. So when, you know, competitors such as FIS and Fiserv are, as you were describing, taking forever to integrate something, Temenos has decided that's not the model. We're going to focus on our core and we're going to build the right type of platform where both fintech and banks can access each other in the right fashion. And all the motivations that you've described are what we talk about every day. And I think the nuances are in execution, like with everything else. The question is, how far along are we all? How good are we at curating? How close we are to plug and play? How useful we are to our banks? In your case, to both sides of the client equation. We don't have partners either. We have clients. We actually charge the fintechs that access the platform as a means. To be very honest, as a means of eliminating the ones that are not quite yet mature to offer a very nominal fee. And we evidently charge our banks as well. We don't, to anticipate your question, we don't contract for them. We're not a single vendor management type of play. It is very open and a very clear model in which kind of everyone should be making money where they're best at. That's the goal of the platform.
Dwayne, in looking at the Temenos marketplace, looks like you've got about 56 or so partners so far. Which ones are the most heavily utilized? You mentioned
that
you're doing more startups too. What's the vetting process? But tell me which ones are your clients using? How do they get into making those decisions?
Very good question. We knew early on that the way we curate the platform is going to make the difference. We have a lot more than 50. There's about 100, and a lot of them are not yet published because they're still in the vetting process. There's probably going to be, we're essentially going to pump the brakes on onboarding providers and spend a lot more time on curation, simply because now we know where the market is focusing. It took us a few months, but what we've done is we've revamped the curation process as effectively as possible. We found very early on that bottling knowledge and then quickly dispersing it throughout the organization in a way that enables us to kind of get the right type of fintech to the right bank is a much harder process than we thought it would be. So we decided to just focus on only onboarding the absolute best in terms of what they do, essentially as a mode of curating it for our banks. So they're looking at us not only to get the technology, but also to get the knowledge of how we ended up with those people. And to finally answer it, we start with a certification process where we look at the technology, we look at their financials, we look at the company in as close of detail as possible. At first, we had loads and loads of people wanting to get in. We still do. We have a very wide pipeline, but we're kind of focusing it. We do some things called innovation jams all over the world, and that's like mini Finovates, if you wish, and that's how fintechs get introduced to us. Plus, what's really interesting, what we see these days, where we've grown in the last few months, is, and the most exciting bit, are when banks themselves are starting to want to have their providers into the marketplace, and they're either recommending someone or helping them with the certification, just getting them in the pipeline. That's very exciting, and I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say, but we even have a couple of own bank products that are going to become one of the fintech that is being sold to other banks. So it's a truly collaborative moment of, if we all work together, then we can all make money.
Yeah. Derek, at Evoca, what's the game plan for expanding the, I don't want to call them partners because that's, but the other providers on the platform? Where do you go from where you're at? Is there a vetting process, an attraction process for finding other providers to put on the platform?
There's there's kind of two approaches. There's the first where we look for the innovative technologies. So we've gone from participating in Finovate on stage to attending Finovate to watch the demos and say, okay, that looked cool. We should have those guys as part of our exchange partnership because we're not trying to be all things to all people. That's what the FISERs and the FISs have been trying to do, and it's not going to work. There's too much innovation happening out there. And the second approach is the purely commercial one of, you know, we have some of the largest financial institutions in the world are using our product. So if they come to us and say, hey, we'd really like to be able to use Vantiv for payments, it's like, okay, that gets prioritized.
So to a certain extent, they're like outsourcing the partnership process to you by doing it. Chris, whereas Derek's customer base are the larger institutions, yours are going to be a whole lot smaller, even the largest credit union space. So who are you working with these days beyond the course to integrate in, and what's your process for identifying additional providers?
It was interesting as we were going through our R&D phase to figure out how to do this. We were scared to death that the fintechs weren't going to come, right? It wasn't going to be a field of dreams scenario where you built this platform and nobody showed up. So we actually, as part of our capital raise, built in the ability to build our own set of base services. What we are finding, though, is we've got 20, we've been booking development partners or development customers since May, and we've already got 20 development customers booked. So, and we are talking about some large core providers like Jack Henry. There's some I can talk about and some I can't talk about. Like Jack Henry, like Vantiv, for example, is also one of ours. So there are some on the very large scale, but then there's also some of these really small startups who have one customer, and they happen to be within our marketplace as far as credit unions go. Really innovative
like
thinkers.
Like who? Can you talk names?
Like Narmi, for example. Narmi is a startup that's a pretty good group of folks developing an online banking platform, as well as there's a firm out of the Northwest called Obloco that does a white label expense tracking for small businesses. So they came to us. We one of our jobs is to get the word out and to do things like this and to talk a little bit about to fintechs about, hey, we're here. The reception we've gotten from them has been much greater than we expected. Because I think some of the frustrations that at least community institutions feel, those fintech providers feel as well, that there's this, in the existing dynamic, there's this wall between the institution and the innovative thinking that's happening out there, and all too often it is that large monolithic provider that's standing in the way. And they'd see it as a means of being able to go around them and come directly to the institution.
Okay, I never thought I'd be in a position of actually defending the large monolithic core, mm-hmm. but one of the benefits of that from a financial institution perspective is single point of contact. I pay one institution.
That's not true. So I respectfully disagree. I've done 25 years in credit.
He is a CIO of a credit union. So if I'm wrong, I'm getting it from the
right. So I've done 25 years in credit unions, half of my career with Navy Federal and half of my career with Coastal Federal in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I'll tell you, I had a relationship with one of the large core providers, and I would have six different salespeople in my office. We did RFPs where two different divisions from the same company came and competed against each other. So it isn't one throat to choke. And the one throat to choke is so high up, so high, you only ever see him at conferences like this where he stands up and gives the keynote and then walks away, right? So it is a disjointed experience in some of those large providers as well. So
then how does the model change with a platform like Constellation? I mean, do you ultimately trying to replace the core as the core replace the core from a system perspective, but from a relationship perspective? How does the pricing change? I was in a meeting, and Jason Hendricks was in that meeting a couple weeks ago with a bunch of bank CEOs, And I talked about this idea of platform services providers. They're like, well, how's that going to work?
Yep.
And I couldn't answer because we didn't have this meeting yet. So help me out for my next meeting.
Okay.
So,
yeah,
I can have something good to say.
So our financial model works on that. The institutions who run our platform pay an annual subscription fee. So that annual subscription fee covers our base services and for operating the platform, running it. We're an Amazon. We're built an Amazon Web Services.
Based on any volume, asset size, what would drive the
one fixed price?
Well, okay.
One fixed price for all institutions. Then what we do as part of being the customers that are in our marketplace selling their services, they have the option to have very close relationships with us. We have some that are investors in our company. And they, like Co-op, for example, CUNA Mutual, they've made investments in our company. So when they sell services on our platform, there actually is no cost to them because they've paid their cost. They made the investment. And then there's others that have annual fees, percentage of sales, all of those kinds of things that helps go toward the support of the platform, the testing, the certification of the services, like Duane discussed, right? I mean, we have all platforms have that same process they have to go through to certify the providers. So we have to recover the cost for that.
Okay, Derek, you guys in the Voca Exchange are a little more focused on the account opening onboarding stuff. So perhaps there's different economics there, but how do you price and how does it change the economics of the account opening, not the process, but the economics of account opening for the banks on the exchange?
So for the banks that are using
and the economics to the providers on the exchange. So what that's why I want to be sure we're focusing on both sides of the platform here.
Yeah. So the providers that we deal with typically operate on a transactional basis, and thankfully so do we. So if we deliver a completed application through to the bank for, say, a checking account or a new loan application, there's a click charge associated with that, which the banks like because it gives us skin in the game. If they have an experience in the market that's not converting, because everybody knows that abandonment for online account opening, loan origination is terrible. So if the bank has an experience in the market that's not converting, we'll actually come back, we'll have the sales rep knock on the door and say, hey, this sucks. You can do better. We know you can do better. We have examples of other clients who are doing better. So we've got that transactional fee. If they then add in things like fraud prevention, identity verification, photo ID capture through us, then we're going to put a markup on the service that they're getting from a MyTech or Yodlee or whoever it is, and that becomes part of our bundled transaction fee. So they can get a direct correlation between the cost of using our service and the revenue associated with acquiring a new customer.
Duane, what about at Temenos? What's the economics?
I'm very envious of Derek's model because of your very clear niche and how easy it is to kind of quantify the win. It's so easy from that perspective. So evidently, we're not talking about core banking pricing for Temenos. I have no clue how we price that. And if I did know, I would probably not be allowed to tell you. But what I do know is all of our financial providers that are coming through the platform have very different types of pricing themselves. We can't change their model. Some of them evidently are doing transactional banking, but others want a fixed yearly fee or some of them are able to do a full on-premise implementation eventually. Some of them want to stay in the cloud. It's so different that we can't really affect their pricing. We have no interest in doing so. Sometimes we help them in terms of kind of advising whether that's too high or it could be higher. You'd be shocked how many people underprice themselves when they're first starting out. But with that said, we only broker that relationship with the bank. What we have done, though, is because we have the banks Temenos has sold to, of the 2,000, there are a number that are tier one, and that's a very clear proposition. But then there are a few of them that are in the same size as the credit unions that you're working with. So what we've done for them, so that they can move slightly faster and even cut some costs, is we've packaged something called an innovation acceleration platform, which is a package of the software, the sandbox, if you wish, plus some knowledge on top of it. And what that allows the banks to do for a subscription with Temenos that's nominally cost them almost no money, it allows them to play with all of our fintech in the marketplace and all of their own fintech. Meaning, you sign up with us in half an hour, you're starting to play with some type of proposition with model bank data. So it's an actual, it's a testing environment that doesn't need that type of approval internally in the procurement and the business prevention department that stops you from everything else. So for them, it's very economical to just get that subscription and start playing and move fast in terms of front-end and relationships. There's no more time for banks to wait, evidently, according to all the things we've been telling them for years. For the bigger banks, they don't necessarily see the value in moving from that perspective, but they are using the same package to move their own fintech propositions through it and kind of become part of the actual marketplace. So the real money in it is what you'd expect in the industry. I mean, there's no more markup from Temenos in terms of licenses for I don't know, a chatbot.
So one of the other benefits of why fintechs want to play within platforms is because there's a captured marketplace there, right? There is the curve you have to get past to educate the potential customer, to sell the customer, to do an RFP and something, all of that melts away when they can click through and say, hey, here's reviews from other institutions, right? Here's screenshots of what it looks like. I mean, part of what we're helping do is shorten that sales cycle, so there's value in that for the fintech providers as well.
You're a trust broker to a large extent. Definitely. You are doing the vetting, not only doing that, but for many of these institutions, they just, as I said before, they don't have the skill sets. Forget just the partnering.
Right.
They don't have the technology skills to do that.
And Chris, you know, you mentioned one of the core providers saying that you were attacking their $400 million mm-hmm. in integration revenue. They should actually be thanking you because community banking is shrinking. Mm-hmm. So whilst they're protecting the $400 million in integration, they are killing the $4 billion in annual revenues that they're making from those banks.
Absolutely.
Because they're not innovating on behalf of those banks. They're holding those banks back. Customers are responding by saying, I'm moving my business somewhere else.
That's right.
Where I can get the mobile experience that I expect.
Yep, you're exactly right. That was part of what...
So
that
it's
was
a short-term... Yep. You know, view that they're taking.
That was part of my message to them. You know, you tell them, you know, I retold the whole Kodak story about Kodak protecting film. I said, you know, don't lose out on a new business model because you're trying to protect your last one.
Yep.
So 2-3 years from now, Chris, I'm going to ask each of you this. 2-3 years from now, how
you
many
first, we'll
provider you get to answer the question wrong first.
Uh-huh.
It's not a right or wrong thing.
Sorry. Right.
Two to 3 years from now, how many fintech providers will be on the Constellation platform?
So when I took over the CEO position, I had to answer that question, actually, and it got written into my performance plan, my long-term performance plan. The good news is we are currently running at about 300% of what that evaluation was. So what I will tell you is I am very confident we will have, in 3 years, 100 providers in that platform.
And from a functionality perspective, line of business, product, whatever,
it touches everything. That's the really cool part. So yes, everything you can think of from the perspective of account opening and bill pay and all of those kind of what I would call, you know, kind of almost old school services, right, will be there. We've got folks bringing on mobile wallets. We've got folks bringing on Alexa, like I want to talk to my phone and ask it questions. Right, we've got folks bringing on a whole variety of really inventive ideas, because what happens when you expose the platform and the data and the functionality that exists inside these organizations, now you can have people come up and say, you know what, I had a really great idea for a wedding planning service that allows, this is an actual example that we're talking with somebody about, that allows somebody to borrow for a wedding and then use P2P, right, to make payments on their loan, right? And there may already be a fintech out there that allows you to do that, but we were talking to somebody about creating that inside of our platform. Once it's exposed, anything can happen.
Derek, 2-3 years from now, how many providers on the exchange?
My expectation is we'll probably have, assuming that our business model stays the same, we're focused on customer acquisition, we'll probably have a couple of hundred. And part of the reason for that is because we operate in three different markets. So we're in the US, we're in Europe, and we're in Australia. And each of the, and as you can tell from my accent, it's as confused as our business. And each of those markets has its own providers for things like identity verification and fraud prevention and credit decisioning. So when we look at, you know, the typical onboarding process, we've got things like photo ID capture, we've got things like address lookups and address validation, identity verification, credit decisioning, risk, device-based fraud. So there's typically about 6 integrations just in that onboarding process. And the goal of everybody, us and our clients, is to reduce the friction for the customer. So we don't want to introduce more. If we are, we want them to be seamless. They've got to be in the background. They've got to be kind of hidden from the customer. So if we said, okay, there's probably 10 services that you might use in anything from checking accounts opening through loan origination, and we probably have about 10 options for each of those, and we're in 3 markets, there's kind of 300. Then as we expand into other geographies, we'll probably see that expand. But then we've got people that we've built integrations to, like Trulioo, who give us identity verification in 45 different countries through one API.
Yeah.
So I can send them an Australian driver's license, and they'll come back and go, found it. I can send them a UK passport, they'll come back and say, found it. Single API call. And some of the banks that we deal with are global institutions who are trying to onboard customers who arrive in this country and say, well, I don't recognize Wells Fargo's brand, but I know who Citibank is, or I know who HSBC is, so I'll try and open an account with them, but I don't have a Colorado driver's license, I've got an Australian driver's license. Doesn't matter. We can actually verify your identity and come back and say, yeah, we found this person. This is a real individual.
Great. Dwayne, have a little less than 60 partners today. In 2 to 3 years, how many and where are they going to come from?
Well, at least one more once we have a conversation.
I just found two more.
And in all honesty, if we're going to be... First of all, I think the number is completely irrelevant. I really don't like that as a KPI. I think it just gives the wrong incentive if we're just trying to get loads of people. But realistically, if we're going to be serious about being a platform, you guys can join as well. Mm-hmm. It's going to hopefully be in the middle of connecting everyone to everyone. So the number is completely irrelevant to me. Hopefully there's going to be, you know, we're going to grow and mature to the point that we could maybe even have other core banking providers. We have our own products, for instance, our own Temenos products are run through the platform. When I built the innovation acceleration package, that was run through the platform as well. So everybody.
But it's also, we're seeing platforms talking to platforms.
Yes.
So Experian are launching CrossCore, where if I'm an Experian customer and I connect to CrossCore, but I want to include a TransUnion credit score, I can do that now through CrossCore or LexisNexis identity verification service. I can do that. So we're connecting to CrossCore, which then opens up another raft of services behind it. So,
with being open, that's the last thing I'm going to say, you can't be half-baked. I was going to use another word. You're either really open or not. Right. The model in which you're protective in any which way just stops working very fast.
Mm-hmm. I live in Colorado. A lot of people are half-baked.
Got time for one last question and ask each of you guys to address this. So how does the developments in AI and blockchain, how's that going to impact the Constellation platform in a longer time frame, Chris?
Well, long term, it's going, we've got hooks kind of shaded in where those are going to come in. So obviously our focus is the first release of our platform, actually the Aquarius release, Constellation, comes out in December. And soon thereafter, we've got subsequent releases. But we have absolutely penciled in and know exactly where the opportunities are going to be to take all of this data that we have about where the member is, what they're doing, the type of services they have, and be able to plug that into an AI engine and be able to give them better products, better services, better recommendations, embedded experiences like Brett talked about. And then additionally, there's blockchain for us is a matter of thinking about that identity security. So one of the keys we had to do in our design was isolate security and identity, right? Because you have all of these different providers, you've got to isolate security and identity. So we're actually pre-staged to be able to make pretty good use of that from an identity standpoint.
Darren?
So blockchain for us will become relevant once it starts to be used for identity. Mm-hmm. So once we get to a point where you know, it frustrates the hell out of me that I have to type in my name and my address and my email and my phone number over and over again, whether I'm signing up for an REI shopping cart or I'm applying for a bank account. It's like, it's the same information. Why can't we store it in one location? We just saw 2 weeks ago what happens when you store all that information in one location. And the blockchain gives us the ability to distribute the storage of that stuff. So I'm waiting for somebody to kind of step in and say, okay, we're going to allow you to store your identity information. We're going to smash it up all over the place so we haven't created a honeypot with real honey inside of it. And so that blockchain really for us, is it's kind of going to become relevant at that point. AI machine learning is completely different. That's something that we're actively looking at the moment. We're generating a lot of data about customer journeys. So somebody applying for a bank account, they're abandoning. Where did they abandon? Why did they abandon? What could the bank potentially do to improve it?
When you say looked at, what does that mean? Looking at vendors to integrate into the platform or to build your own capabilities around?
We're looking at both. So the partners that we're looking at are more in the kind of fraud prevention, risk assessment, and so on. So applying that kind of AI to say, I've got all this data available through various bureaus and so on. How do I use that to actually determine if this customer is going to be a good customer or not such a good customer? You know, the typical blacklists of credit files and so on are coming under a lot of pressure from the CFPB. So the banks are looking at alternatives, and we're looking at the vendors that could potentially give the banks those alternative approaches to credit and identity verification and risk assessments. But we're also looking at technologies that we can incorporate into our solution. More at the kind of less of the exchange partners, and more like we're leaning on vendors to say, we don't want to build an AI capability or machine learning necessarily. What have you got that we could be feeding data into to derive intelligence from it?
Duane, who's the biggest threat to the Temenos? Who or what is the biggest threat to the Temenos marketplace?
I didn't think you asked what this gentleman answered a second ago. I think you were asking, who's going to win this thing? And what's the point of us making this big platform if it's all going to be integrated within Siri? And I think that there's a couple of answers to that. I'm not going to go into the fancier ones. But on an immediate level, all the new technologies are just stuff that banks can play with so that maybe they win at this relationship game, and we're trying to get them to move fast enough that they don't lose all of it. That's on the short term. We're evidently looking, Temenos is building all kinds of cool stuff on the core side of things, where evidently blockchain makes a difference and integrating machine learning is necessary. But on the front end and where marketplace is, these are just weapons we're trying to get in the hands of banks fast enough that they don't completely lose the plot.
Excellent. Well, we are out of time, so I want to ask you guys to thank our panelists here for great information, and appreciate you guys coming out and doing that.
Thanks, Rob.
Thanks,
guys.
Thanks, Rob.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.